Let's take our Bibles and find our way to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9. We're going to finish up this chapter today, finally, and beyond to chapter 10. And I'm excited about what's ahead of us. But there is going to be some recycling of some of the material that we're going to be hearing from Daniel that's recycled in other visions in chapter 11 and chapter 12. So if some of this gets a little fuzzy, just know that we're going to have a chance to come at it again in the next two chapters. Daniel chapter 9. Let me read the context for us. We've been spending a few weeks in this, in verses 20 through 27. You'll remember that Daniel is praying, and he gets interrupted by Gabriel in this passage. Daniel chapter 9, verse 20. Now, while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain of my God, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. He gave me instruction and talked with me and said, "Oh, Daniel, I have now come forth to give you insight with understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. So, give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood, even to the end that there will be war. Desolations are determined or decreed. He will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate." I want to read to you from a description that I found this week on Amazon. And it's a description of the original 12-volume set of the Left Behind series. Let me read to you from that introduction. It says this. I'm not quite as dramatic as it sounds, but I'll give it my best shot. "Are you ready for the moment of truth? Mass disappearances, political crisis, economic crisis, worldwide epidemics, environmental catastrophe, military apocalypse. And that's just the beginning. It's the beginning of the end of the world. The 12 books in the series by New York Times bestselling authors Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins cover the events of biblical prophecy surrounding the rapture and the seven-year period known as the tribulation that follows," end quote. In case you were wondering, and I was, the Left Behind series sold over 80 million copies. And I was just thinking, if they just got a dollar for every... No, I wasn't. Listen, I'm not going to give a critique of the Left Behind series this morning, except to say that I would caution any believer deeply to consider the wisdom of reading or watching fiction about truth. Just think of those two words in the same sentence. Reading fiction about truth. Look, that goes for the portrayal of any biblical content, whether it be the Left Behind series, The Chosen, or even The Passion of the Christ. I think we have to exercise extreme caution in allowing facts, suggestions, even theology to be kind of garbled up together from someone's imagination and then added speculation to the biblical accounts that they are referencing. I don't doubt the motives of some of these folks, but I made a decision a long time ago because of my weakness, not my strength, that I have to be really careful watching fiction about truth, because when I'm in the middle of preaching, it's in my mind. And when my mind goes back to grab a narrative, I want to make sure it's what the Bible says and not what I saw on a screen. Now, the reason I bring that up this morning is just to give you a little perspective. The contents of those thousands of pages that fill 12 volumes of that Left Behind series is contained in Daniel in one verse, Daniel 9:27. That tells you that there's probably a lot left to speculation, right? Verse 27, he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. I know that those volumes deal with the book of Revelation as well, but everything that they cover, Daniel does in one verse. We've been studying the book of Daniel, and it pronounces over and over and over that God has planned out all of history. History will play out according to his precise plan down to the date. That's on a macro level with nations and on a micro level with you and with me. Now, we have to be mindful when we study eschatology, the end times, the way the world's going to end, which we're going to see here in this passage, to avoid two extremes. The first extreme is we would do well to adopt a humble attitude toward our own interpretations and openly admit, and I do this morning, that we do not understand everything about eschatology and the end times. Even Daniel had to have help in his understanding by an angel back in chapter 8, verse 27. He needed help to figure it out, and so do we. But that could tempt you to fall off the road on the other side in a ditch. Another extreme, and that is that we would do well by not giving up on difficult passages. They are indeed intended to tell us something, to teach us something, to reveal something to us. God is not playing hide and seek with his meaning of his text. He wants us to understand. He's not revealing things about the end of the world, elbowing the angels and say, I bet that's got them confused. That's not our God. He is a God of perspicuity and clarity. We began our study two weeks ago, and we're given a timestamp, a significant timestamp. This is the Medo-Persian Empire in verse 1. It's the first year of the reign of Darius. Daniel is having his quiet time. He's reading in the scroll or the book of Jeremiah, and he realizes what Jeremiah prophesied, that the reason that the people would go into exile in Babylon was to be disciplined for disobeying the honoring of Sabbath years. They had disobeyed 70 times. It was supposed to happen every 7 years. So for 490 years, they had disobeyed, according to 2 Chronicles. So they had to go into exile for 70 years. He's reading in Jeremiah and realizes, gets his Babylonian abacus out, and realizes, we're close to the end of 70. It's time to go home. And his response is prayer. He doesn't do a touchdown dance of celebration. He drops to his knees and he prays. And he prays for weeks. He fasts. Even though he was brought over to exile as a young teenager, maybe 12, 13 years old, and probably hadn't committed the sins that all the other people had, certainly not for 490 years, but he identifies with the people so much, he says, Lord, forgive us. As he's praying, Gabriel the angel interrupts him. Now, typically, it's not a godly thing to interrupt someone's prayer, but when an angel comes, it's okay. Now, we looked at this in the last 2 weeks. I'm just going to very quickly summarize what we've done in the last 2 weeks. We looked, first of all, at the preparation for the prophetic panorama, looking down to the end of time, the preparation. And it happens in verses 20 to 23. Let me just highlight those for you. Now, while I was speaking and praying, we did note that Daniel was praying out loud. He was speaking. There's something to be said, I think, for us learning to talk to God out loud. You can certainly talk to God in your heart. He knows everything. You can pray silently. You can pray in the midst of a crowd when no one even knows you're praying. But it just is convicting to me that Daniel is praying out loud. We know he did that earlier, and that's what he was thrown in the lion's den about. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, presenting my supplication before the Lord in behalf of the holy mountain, that's Mount Moriah, Jerusalem, of my God, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, don't be confused, we already know from chapter 7 that Gabriel is an angel. Why is he saying the man Gabriel? Because he looks like a man. And as we've said for the last few weeks, if you want to know why that's significant, just read Revelation 4 and 5 and look at what angels look like in those chapters. The fact that he's looking like a man here is he probably had some visions of other angels, and he says Gabriel looked like a man in human form. He says, this is the one, the man I had seen previously in my other vision, came to me in my extreme weariness. He's been fasting and praying for a long time about the evening offering. That's 3 or 4 p.m., even though there wasn't an evening offering in Babylon. He was still operating on Jerusalem time. He gave me instruction, verse 22, talked to me and said, oh, Daniel, I've come forth to give you insight and understanding. Don't miss that. This is intended to be understood, not to be confused by. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you, you are highly esteemed. We looked at that. What a sweet thing that God noticed Daniel, and this word means precious, treasured. You've been highly valued by God. Should have blown Daniel away that he had caught the eye of God. So give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. Understand what I'm telling you. He hasn't even finished his prayer when God gives him this vision, answers his prayer. It's going to be good news and bad news. The bad news is that the kingdom is not going to be established right now. The one that you saw in Nebuchadnezzar's dream and in your own, it's not going to be established right now. There's some tough times coming, but in the end, God wins. Bad news and good news. That led us to look at the following verses, verses 24 to 27. And we find in those verses two anchors for understanding God's prophetic panorama. Two anchors for understanding the end of time, God's prophetic panorama. The first anchor is in verse 24. It's very simple, this vision he sees. 70 weeks have been determined by God. And as we looked at last week, that means 490 years. Verse 24, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Gabriel reveals this vision to Daniel, his esteemed friend who's been looked upon favorably by God, and says, listen, 70 periods of seven. It's an interesting Hebrew word, Shabuah. Units of seven. 70 sevens have been decreed for you. Now, we went into great detail last week to talk about why we understand these as years, and there's an elaborate, reasonable understanding of that. First of all, in chapter 10, we'll see next week, he talks about 70 units of yom, days. He says the Hebrew word yom, day. Here it doesn't, just 77. So what does that mean? Well, it's interesting to take it as years because it makes perfect sense when you lay out the map. 70 units of 7 years. Why do we call it weeks? Well, it became a euphemism, this seven sevens, or sevens rather, grouped together, became a euphemism for a week. It seems most natural to take these 70 sevens to refer to years, 490 years in other words. It was very common for the Hebrew to talk about these groups of 7 years. They thought, as we've said before, in base 7. We think in base 10. They thought in the rhythm of a week. They thought in the rhythm of Sabbath years. They thought in the rhythm of Sabbath rests. We think in the rhythm of tens. Also, we have to remember that we're going to see when you calculate the number of years from Daniel's time and the decree of Artaxerxes to the time of Jesus, it comes out exactly to the numbers that are calculated. We'll see that here in just a moment. All of these numbers align when these weeks are understood as years. Harold Honer says, the 70-year captivity was due to the Jews having violated 70 Sabbath years over a 490-year period, and Daniel now saw 70 units of sevens decreed for another 490 years into Israel's future. Again, we looked at that more deeply last week. That first anchor is, look, 70 years have been decreed, 70 units of seven, 70 weeks rather, have been decreed, which are units of 7 years. Now we know in the second anchor that these 70 weeks involve three distinct divisions. Seven is the first division. In fact, let me just lay it out for you. It's seven and then 62 and then one. The first 7 weeks, which is 49 years, are given to rebuild Jerusalem. We know that because that's what the text says. So you are to know, verse 25, and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 units, 7 weeks, 49 years. Daniel is to know this and discern this. So when do we start these 70 weeks? Well, he tells us right here, when the decree is given to go rebuild Jerusalem, not rebuild the temple. Two other decrees were given to rebuild the temple. This is not this one. You say, well, what is this? Well, it's Nehemiah chapter 2 is the only place we have where Artaxerxes says, go rebuild the city, not just the temple. Notice he begins by saying these first, no, you got to track with me here. They're the first 69 weeks, remember there are 70 weeks, the first 69 have divisions. And those divisions are with 7 and 62 weeks. That's what it says right in the text. The first 7 weeks are 49 years, and the second will follow being 62 weeks, or 434 years. By the way, just to let you know, in Nehemiah 2, verse 3 and Nehemiah 2, verse 5, both of those verses give the decree of Artaxerxes that says, go rebuild the city, not just the temple. Why is that important? Because we know when that happened. Exactly. Nisan 1 on the Jewish calendar, March 5th, 444 BC. We have a time stamp. We know exactly when that happened. Now, I want you to track here a little bit, because after the seven follows, there are 62 weeks from the rebuilding of Jerusalem to the arrival of Messiah. What, by the way, why is it 7 weeks? Why is it 49 years? Well, it just so happens it took the Jews 49 years to rebuild Jerusalem. Then you have the second period, this 62 weeks or 434 years. To 7 and 62 weeks, verse 25, it will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. It's going to be a tough time, and they were constantly harassed in the rebuilding of the temple and the city. So you got 7 weeks, 49 years, 62 weeks, 434 years. That adds up to 483 years, leaving seven left of the 490 that are prophesied. So, just for a second, follow the tracking, okay? The decree to build the city is March 5th, 444 BC. The end point of these first two units, the 69 weeks that began in 444, will be 483 years later. Now, if you calculate that according to the biblical prophetical years, and we'll see in the book of Revelation why we do this in just a moment, that's a 360-day year, not 365. You might be interested to know that the 365-day year did not come until 1582, issued by Pope Gregory XIII. That's why we call it the Gregorian calendar. So, think about this. If we take 360 days as a year, multiplied by 483 years, that's the first section less the last week, you get 173,880 days. So when does this start? March 5th, 444. If you add 173,880 days in the Jewish calendar to that date, you get March 30th, AD 33. Why is that important? Because scholars tell us that was Palm Sunday, when Jesus walked in and was momentarily received as king. But 4 days later, which the text tells us after that 69th week, 4 days later, the Messiah would be cut off. That's the crucifixion of Jesus. And that's where we come to the Messiah being cut off in verse 26. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off, crucified, have nothing. That means he did not inherit the kingdom that we saw back in the rock growing to inherit the and fill the whole earth in Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. That didn't happen. He had nothing. Then he gives us a historical footnote. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood, even to the end that there will be war. Desolations are predetermined, are cast in front of you. What is that? Well, notice very carefully, it says the people of the prince who is to come. Who is the prince who is to come? Well, we find him in the next verse, and we'll discover that's the ultimate antichrist in the book of Revelation. Tell you why in just a moment. But notice it doesn't say he comes. That's later. That's in the 70th week. It says the people of him, the people. That's the extension of the fourth kingdom that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his vision, the prophecy of the Roman reconstituted empire. When John sees this in his vision in the book of Revelation, he calls this ruler the beast. Doesn't say the beast himself will destroy Jerusalem, only that the people of the nation which will emerge from him will destroy Jerusalem. That was accomplished in AD 70 when the Romans completely crushed the city of Jerusalem. Jesus told his disciples that was coming in Matthew 24. We'll look at that in just a moment. That brings us now to verse 27, which we want to look at with some detail. And that is letter C, the final divided week. So remember, the 70 is divided into three sections. The first 7 weeks, which are 49 years, rebuild the city. The intermediate 62 weeks, that's what we call the intertestamental period. And that's when the life of Christ comes at the very end of that. And then there's 1 week that's a bit of an orphan to this 70. 7, 62, and 1. Verse 27. And he, remember that, we're going to talk about this he in a second, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, for 7 years. In the middle of this seven-year period, this week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offerings. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes this desolation desolate. The vision has so far covered 69 weeks or 483 years. But the vision is of 70 weeks. What about the last 7 years that make up that 490 or the 70 weeks? Well, let's first establish that these weeks or units of seven are best, again, understood as years. Consequently, the last week is a seven-year period that is uniquely carved away from the first seven and the second 62-week divisions. We've already seen that the first 69 weeks, those first two added together, end with Messiah coming to Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, March 30th, AD 33. And here's the critical understanding we need to glean from verse 27. This final week for Daniel, that 70th week, remained future for Daniel, but it remains future for you and me as well. Why do we know that? Because what's prophesied in verse 27, in the 70th week, has not happened yet. Remember, verse 26 talks about Messiah being cut off after the 69th week. Not during the 69th week and not during the 70th week. It's in between. So the question is, why is there a supposed gap between the 69th and the 70th weeks? First, nothing is said about the time of the destruction of the city, but only the certainty of it. We know that this destruction that's prophesied in verse 26 took place 38 years after the end of the 69th week. Gabriel tells Daniel that the wars and rumors of wars would continue until the end, but not a word is mentioned about when that would come to a final conclusion. The prediction of these wars and the times of wars implies a long cyclical interval. There are two events predicted in verse 26, the cutting off of Messiah and the destruction of the city and his sanctuary. But take note that these events do not take place in either the 69th or the 70th weeks. The text is explicit that they occur after the 69, but not during the 70th. We can therefore deduce an implied gap between the 69th and the 70th weeks. When was the city of Jerusalem destroyed? We know that. AD 70, when Titus Vespasian from Rome wiped out Jerusalem, tore it down, removed stone upon stone, just as Jesus predicted. And the math is pretty clear. The crucifixion of Jesus and the destruction of the temple are separated by almost 40 years, 38 years. Consequently, we know that there is at least a 38-year gap between the 69th and 70th weeks, and it went a lot longer than that. Here's the crucial observation to make. The events in verse 27 have not occurred yet. So it makes sense for us to reason that we are still in that gap, which Paul will tell us in Ephesians 2 and 3 is the mystery of the church. In other words, the church age was not predicted in the Old Testament as clearly as this was. Paul said it wasn't known to them. So in chapters 2 and 3 of Ephesians, he unpacks that. The church age is the mystery not revealed in the Old Testament. The church age occurs then during the gap between the 69th and the 70th week. You say, well, hang on. I mean, what? There's no gap in those first 69 years. How can we assume that there would be a gap? Do you know that Jesus affirms a gap? In Matthew 24, he quotes Daniel. He quotes this passage. And Jesus says in Matthew 24, 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through the prophet Daniel, Standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Now, let's talk about this for a second. Because we're going to come back in chapter 11 to our friend, that's a terrible way to say it. We're going to come back to study Antiochus Epiphanes, a horrific man in history who actually desecrated the temple, accomplished an abomination of desolation, which was predicted by Daniel, that he went into the temple, claimed himself to be God, and then offered a pig on the altar of the temple, which is a prefiguring of what Jesus says. Now, how do we know that all that this abomination of desolation is in the future and not that? Because Jesus is saying this 200 years after Antiochus. And he says the abomination of desolation is still in the future, which tells us that Jesus affirmed a gap between the 69th and the 70th week very clearly. Now, I told you to put a little place marker. Let's go back to verse 27. We have to answer the question of this. Who is the he at the beginning of the verse? And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. So in the 70th week, which is separated from the other 69, there's a he, there's a prince, a person who's going to make a covenant with the many. Who is that? Well, there are three major views. Some think that it was Antiochus Epiphanes, but we know it's not him because Jesus says this is still in the future, so he's instantly ruled out. Other people say, well, no, this is Jesus. The he is Jesus. Others still say that it's the Antichrist or the beast of Revelation 13. Let's just pick that apart a little bit. Could this be Jesus making a covenant with the many for 1 week? Well, I find this an untenable, unacceptable interpretation. Why? Because according to this view, Christ makes a covenant with the many for 7 years. This is nowhere else supported in the Bible. In fact, when you see Christ making covenants or promises, they're eternal, they're forever. It's completely out of character of Jesus to say, I'm going to make a little promise for 7 years and then I'm going to blow it up. Secondly, okay, we got to go back to 10th grade English for a second, okay? I want to see some north and south and some east and west right here, okay? Do you remember the law of the nearest antecedent? How many remember that? Don't lie. The nearest antecedent is really simple. It's the nearest reference. In other words, if you use a pronoun, he or she, and you don't know who that is, then you go back to the nearest noun, the nearest other person that it references, and that's the reference. That's the nearest antecedent, right? Didn't know you were coming to a 10th grade English class this morning, did you? Interesting. Who's the nearest antecedent for this he? Verse 26 tells us it's the Antichrist, the prince who the Romans, even though they didn't know they were operating under his auspices, they were still operating under the anti-God, anti-God's people edict. The nearest antecedent or reference to the he is the prince of verse 26, who is the Antichrist. In fact, it's most important to keep two princes in this passage distinct. The prince of verse 25 is the Messiah, it says so explicitly, and the prince of verse 27 is the future Antichrist of Revelation 13:8, the beast. Just a little footnote. Our amillennial friends, and they are our friends, believe that the events of the 70th week are played out over a long period of time. But here's the question. If the first 69 weeks were literal all the way down to Palm Sunday, shouldn't the last seven be literal as well? 7 years? Back to the text. He will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. Remember, the context of this is Gabriel telling Daniel to know what's coming for the Jewish nation. So the many here are speaking of the majority of Jews with whom the Antichrist will make a deal during this final tribulation period, this final 7-year period. Just a little historical footnote. What begins the final week is a covenant made, not the rapture. This is what begins the last week is. Now, if that lines up, so be it. I happen to believe that's the best way to take it. But the key is, this covenant. This is the big deal on the world stage. We can easily understand why this would make sense. To make a covenant with Israel, the Antichrist might ensure the nation of Israel, the Jews, safety and security, as this Jewish nation will be, as it has always been, surrounded by enemy Arab nations. Stephen Miller deduces, Antichrist, on behalf of his empire, will make a treaty with the nation of Israel. This agreement probably entails a promise of protection in return for certain favors, likely including those of an economic nature. It's easy to understand why Israel would enter into such an arrangement with the powerful forces of Antichrist. With such protection, Israel would feel safe and secure. Can you see? I don't know if this is going to be another 1,000 years or not, but can you see where the most powerful person on the planet making a treaty of security with Israel would make sense? But in the middle of the week, something happens. He puts a stop to the sacrifices. Little footnote, that implies that the temple will be rebuilt. I was talking with some people. I mentioned this last week, but I'll mention it again today because I was talking with some people this morning after first service about this. They say, well, there's no temple. The tribulational period, the 7 year, the last week starts. And before the middle of the week, 3.5 years, the temple is going to be rebuilt. How will they do that? You do recognize that that's a smaller structure than the Cathedral of Notre Dame, which they said would take 20 years to rebuild, and they did it in less than 5. You don't think if the most powerful person on the planet says, we're going to rebuild the temple for you, they can't knock that out pretty quickly? By the middle of the tribulation period, the 7 year, the final week, sacrifices will be offered. The temple will be up and running again. I don't know how long it'll be up and running again, but in the middle of that week, at the 3.5 year mark, he puts a stop to Jewish worship, to the sacrifice and to grain offering. The covenant he makes with Israel, this treaty he makes, comes to a screeching halt. He turns on Israel. The sacrificial system they had come to reestablish is obliterated. The ending of Jewish temple worship will begin then the final 3.5 years, which the book of Revelation tells us is the great tribulation. Now, what I find fascinating is, I'm going to do this really quick. We will have a chance to come back to this in chapter 12. But this last 3.5 years of Jacob's trouble, difficulty, extreme tribulation, the great tribulation, 3.5 years, this actually gives me chills when you look at the corroboration here. Listen to this. It goes from general to specific. In Daniel 7, he will speak out, speaking of the Antichrist, against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will intend to make alterations to time in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time, 3.5 years. He said, that's kind of general. Well, he says the exact same thing in chapter 12, Daniel 12, 7. Times, time, and half a time. You say, well, that 3.5 years, that's how do we know that's 3.5 years? Revelation 11, 2. Leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it. It's talking about the final 3.5 years of the tribulation. For it has been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. That just happens to be 3.5 years. He says 42 months exactly again in Revelation 13, 5. But this is what I find very interesting. In Revelation 12, 6, speaking of this period, This is incredible. Remember, how many days was it in a Jewish year? 360. Remember that. A woman fled in the wilderness, representing Israel, where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she would be nourished for 1,000, this is Revelation 12, 6, 1,260 days. If you take 360 and multiply it times 3.5, you know what you get? 1,260 days. And then again in Revelation 12, 14, it quotes Daniel and says, this was all prepared for a time and times and half a time. The corroboration of this timing is unmistakable. So during this 3.5 years, the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period, the Great Tribulation as it's called, the Antichrist will attempt to eliminate Jewish worship by putting a stop to the sacrifices and grain offerings on the wing of abominations and will come to his own end in desolation. Let me just give you a little footnote. We're going to study this when we get to the book of Revelation, but know this, that I firmly believe that the worship that is happening in the temple is still apostate. Because even in that, there are going to be 144,000 Jewish evangelists who are going to be convincing people that Jesus is the Messiah. He pays for sin, not what's happening in the temple. We'll save that for a little bit down the road. Paul tells us, by the way, that the Antichrist will assume such power during this time that he will demand that people worship him as God. 2 Thessalonians 2:4 and Revelation 13:8. So Daniel's vision goes on to see that he will cause abominations. That's what Jesus is referring to. But he will also come to his own end. As we've seen, and we're going to see again in chapter 11, by the way, this abomination of Antiochus Epiphanes that happened in the 2nd century BC serves as a foreshadowing of what Antichrist will do and what will happen to him during the tribulation. But we know that Antiochus was not the fulfillment of that because Jesus says, I read it earlier in Matthew 24, 15, when you see in the future the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet. So he saw that Daniel knew that this was at the end in the 70th week. Jesus affirms that. But there's good news. It's going to get bad. The Jews are going to be the object of 3.5 years of a respite, and then the whole world is going to turn on them. Oh, I can't wait till we see where that battle, they come to crush them in Israel in a valley called Megiddo, and Jesus shows up. But that's for another book. Despite his wicked attempts to snuff out God's people, to snuff out God's ways, Antichrist will experience what the text says here, a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. The one who crushed God's people will be crushed himself, Daniel says, or actually Gabriel says to Daniel. He's headed for destruction. The wing of abominations will come that makes one desolate until the end. Until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, God has called his end, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Paul talks about this moment. In 2 Thessalonians 2:8, Paul says, then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring an end by his appearing and by his coming, which we will line up that happens at the end of the tribulation at a great battle in the Megiddo Valley, which we call Armageddon. So what's that look like? If you're watching a live stream, you can just listen. Aaron, I tried it earlier and it didn't work. Command to rebuild. First 49 years, the temple of, the Jerusalem is rebuilt. In the intervening 434 years, that's the intertestamental period. The prophets stop here. At the very end of that period, the life of Christ comes to this planet. Notice that I have the cross a little bit to the right of that dotted line when the 69th year, you put those together, ends, because it says he's cut off after that 69th week. Now, Paul says in Ephesians 2 and 3, we're in the mystery, the church age. One day there is coming a seven-year future, the 70th week, at the beginning of which there's going to be a treaty made by the Antichrist. In the middle of it, he will break it. At the end will be Armageddon and then 1,000 years of Jesus' reign on the planet. I just look at this and say, what a God. It's discernible, isn't it? It's not always easy, but it makes sense. Key days to remember. March 5th, 444 BC, that was the command by Artaxerxes, Nehemiah 2, to rebuild the city. March 30th, AD 33, the triumphal entry of Jesus. After that is the crucifixion, Messiah cut off, April 3rd, AD 33. That's in Matthew 27, that's in Mark 15, that's in Luke 23, that's in John 19. And then the destruction of the temple is August 6th, AD 70. So here's an interesting and I think critical takeaway from this whole study. There's a verse that I memorized when I was in junior high, and I didn't realize that I was memorizing it out of context, but I was. But I want you to hear it in context now. In Jeremiah 29:11, God says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope." You know who that was given to? These Jews in exile. What's the principle? No matter how bad the news tells you life is, and it will be reporting truth, there is a future and a hope. I hate to kind of pull things together in another passage, but may I? In 2 Peter, Peter is talking and he says, "The day of the Lord will come like a thief, which the heavens will pass away with a roar, elements will be destroyed with intense heat, the earth and its works will be burned up." It's coming judgment. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, here's the question he asks: what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? That's the same thing that Jeremiah says. Your future and your hope is based on your holiness. Looking on for the hastening, coming the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by the burning, the elements will melt, intense heat. But according to his promise, we are looking for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. That's part of the second coming in Daniel chapter 9 that's prophesied. Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, you know eschatology, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless, and regard the patience of our Lord as salvation. If you go back up in the passage, you find out what patience means. We say, oh, there's a big gap, a couple thousand years. Could that happen? Well, Peter tells us that a day, a month, a year, 1,000 years, all the same to the Lord. He's not trapped or tripped up by our time frame. But he says very quick, very carefully, regard the patience of our Lord as salvation. In other words, we have an opportunity to avoid the coming judgment because of the gospel. He says two things. Your response to understanding the future is holiness and blamelessness. Put that together with Jeremiah. Understanding the future is to give us hope and holiness. There's the takeaway. Hope and holiness. God wins in the end. but it's going to look pretty bleak until then. Wages of sin is death. It shouldn't surprise us. Hope and holiness. I know that's a lot, but there's a lot coming still in 11 and 12. So let's just keep our minds engaged on what this is.